Welcome to Views from the Corner Office, a conversation with private sector leaders who influence and impact the federal market. Views from the Corner Office delivers a perspective on technology, acquisition, and leadership issues through the lens of executives who lead the federal practices of government contractors. Now your host, Jason Miller.
My guest today is Walter Barnes, the president of PM Consulting Group. Walter, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Views from the Corner Office, we're entering our second year. This is all about not you as the vendor, but what you are experiencing in the federal market. And I'm glad to say that you are probably the first solely professional services company I've had on the show. You guys work in multiple different areas that we'll get into. You're also a small business. You're also 8A. You're also HubZone. So there's a ton there that your vision or your experience will be different than all the other big companies I've talked to. So I'm very happy to have you here. But I'd like to start off with the state of the union, if you will. As a professional services contractor, is it a good time to be a federal contractor?
Yeah, I think it's a great time. I think that there's a lot of opportunity in the federal space. There's a lot of information out there that the government has been good at pushing out to the vendors. But, it really makes for a lot more planning, a lot more strategic development as far as, you know, what are you doing in the market? You know, what is your skill set? What are your capabilities? Do you have the proper infrastructure? But the opportunity space is definitely there. It's very competitive as well. I mean, even in the 8A space, we see a ton of competition. So I think it's a great time to be a federal contractor, and we definitely enjoy what we do.
You bring up the two things here. Number one, competition, which we'll get to in a second. But the other piece of it that I think is very interesting is you have to really define what is your skill set, what are your capabilities. Do you find that that is important today more than ever? Because professional services, what is that, right? What we all do, we all are professional services. Why is that market piece, the capabilities piece, more important today than maybe 3, 5, 7, 10 years ago?
Professional services, to me, you're right. It's very broad, right? So, and if you look at the types of contracts that we have, they range in nature, right? So you have administrative support contracts. We also put IT services in that professional services realm, as well as our healthcare support services. So as far as defining your capabilities, I think it's important for small businesses to really go to market with value, right? And so some small businesses will say, well, I can do just about anything. But I think it's very important to kind of go in with a very focused capability set. And it's easier to communicate with your clients and potential clients when you go in with that approach. And that's not to say that you wouldn't widen that capability set as the opportunities present themselves. You may do that through strategic hires or any other method, but definitely being able to define exactly who you are, what you do in the market, and the value you bring to your federal clients is extremely important nowadays.
Now, a lot of times being a small business is tough in the federal market. There's, as you said, a lot of competition, but it's also the push and pull of, well, the government has goals, but they rarely hit their goals. I think it's 2 years in a row that the government-wide goal of 23% for small business contracts is hit. But many times, a lot of agencies miss it. And, you know, a lot of times it's DOD that really, as DOD goes, so does the rest of the government. What's it like to be a small business? What's the environment like for a small business?
Looking at the goals and which agencies hit their goals is one way to kind of find certain opportunities or certain areas of interest. Personally, we haven't approached it that way. I think, you know, as we start to look at the years that we're in the 8A, we have, you know, the 9 years and we're in year three right now. The thought that always comes in my mind is, you know, what are we going to do when we graduate, right? Or what if we size out of being a small business? So while we look at the goals per agency, we don't make that kind of a priority. You know, we focus on establishing that relationship with the client and seeing where we can help them solve business problems.
So, but if you see an agency, and let's pick on an agency because it's fun to do that, because you said you're in the healthcare field. So let's say Indian Health Service, and you see that they have not met their small business goal for 5 years running. And I don't know if they have, so no insult to those folks at Indian Health Service. Do you pitch yourself to say, hey, we see you have this need, but we also are these checkboxes?
It's always a secondary conversation, part of the conversation for us, to be honest. You know, I think you hit the nail on the head when we go in and say, we see that you have these needs. And oh, by the way, we're helping agency XYZ on this side of the house with those same exact problems. And here are some of the lessons learned and things like that. And we're 8A and we're hub, you know, kind of we can help you check those boxes as well. But certainly going in is that part of the discussion, that piece of the discussion is secondary.
And what's the reaction you get from the federal clients and federal agencies about being a small business? Do they want to talk to you? Is it hard to get a meeting? A lot of times small businesses, there's a lot of sometimes frustration that comes in when they say, well, no one will meet with me or nobody will give me the time because, you know, I show up and all they want to do is talk to the bigger companies. What experience are you guys having?
Over time, we've seen that evolve, right? So there's, I feel like in the government space, there's been a push to give small businesses more access. I think it's incumbent upon the small business, but the small businesses to research, understand, you know, do all the capture work before you go into that meeting. The more of us that go into that meeting understanding their business problems and how we can apply our solutions to add value, the more they'll be willing to meet with other small businesses. I think it's been, you know, accessibility has been better. It can always get better. We've noticed a lot of momentum, right? So we did a lot of sub work initially. We got our first two prime contracts in 2017, and then that kind of opened up the door. And what I have always felt is that, you know, that government client wants to know if you can manage this contract. You know, are you a low risk service provider? Do you have the infrastructure? And I think once you start accumulating more prime contracts, it's real proof that you actually have that capability.
Tell me the story about that first prime contract a little bit. Did it come, did you know you're getting it, or did someone kind of, you go into the agency and they were like, hey, Walter, come here, I want to talk to you. We have this opportunity we think would be perfect for you. Or did you bid on something kind of, we were one of 10 and we just happened to win?
From a capture and business development standpoint, we have a few business development professionals that we work with. Our first prime contract was basically the work that business development professional had done for us in trying to communicate to this particular client, hey, you know, PM Consulting Group's a good company. They have good management. You know, Walter grew up in the federal space 20 years kind of thing. It's almost like give them a shot, you know, if you will, you know. And so we were able to actually secure it that way. We met the client beforehand and again, had an honest conversation of some of their challenges and how we can help them. And they felt comfortable moving forward with the contract.
And that's one of the big benefits of the 8A program as well, is that they can do a sole source contract under a certain amount of dollars. Right. And so even if it's, you know, a small dollar amount from your perspective, it's still that prime, that check mark you get. And as soon as you get one, it kind of opens the door for a bunch of others, hopefully.
Yeah, absolutely. That's been exactly our experience. And you hit on the dollar amount. It wasn't so much the dollar amount, whether it was large or small. It was just honestly the feeling of, you know, getting that first opportunity where you're in first position, where you can interact directly with the client. You can talk to them about, you know, other opportunities that they may have or other issues they're facing that you can help with or even bring in partners to help with. It was a interesting experience, the first prime contract that we got.
You said something that's always amazes me about the government contracting environment. You said being a prime allows us to interact with the client. And I know that the rules, if you will, whether written or unwritten, is that the prime is anyone that can talk to the client and the sub just kind of does their job. And I always thought it was amazing that why wouldn't you want the subcontractor involved in that conversation with the government? Because a lot of times the subcontractor is doing work that is critical to the overall project. So for you not to be able to talk to me as the client, it just blows my mind. And I don't know if you have private sector experience, if it's the same in the private sector and that's just the environment we all live in, or if there's something different about the government world.
We work very hard to get these prime contracts. And subbing is one of those things where, you know, it's very important to establish that good relationship with your subcontractors. and help them understand, okay, here's the mission, here's what we're trying to accomplish. We personally have not, in our role as a prime, we don't really prohibit our subs from talking to the client. But all I ask of them is, let's have an open discussion on how we approach the client. Because in reality, that sub may bring something that we don't have, which is typically why they're there in the first place. And the client may still view us as that vehicle to get to more services, and whether those services come through us or through the sub. But again, I do understand why some prime contractors are very apprehensive. They don't want their subs to go, you know, behind their backs. So we try to advocate for an open conversation with the subs, and we try to actually partner with subs that we trust. I think that's the critical piece.
And hopefully you're not bringing on subs you don't trust.
Right.
That'd be a bad thing. All right, Walter, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we can talk a little bit about the trends in the marketplace. My guest is Walter Barnes, the president of PM Consulting Group. I'm Jason Miller, and you're listening to Views from a Corner Office on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back. You're listening to Views from a Corner Office on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest today is Walter Barnes, the president of PM Consulting Group. Let's talk about some trends you're seeing in the federal marketplace, both from maybe the professional services perspective, but also as a small business. Maybe two or three trends that stand out to you.
One of the trends is competitive pricing. As we started to move away from primarily looking at subcontracted work, moving into, let's say, 8A directed award work, and then moving into 8A competitive or full and open work, pricing has been critical, especially in the professional services place, right? So you're looking at a lot of contracts where you're turning over incumbents and things like that. A lot of times you get into these price shootouts. I think having a good handle on your cost structure, pricing models, and what's in and out, you know, and having that good financial management support on your team is extremely important. But competitive pricing is a trend that I think, you know, anyone in the federal space will agree with me on that. It's becoming extremely difficult, right, to really get to that right price. The other thing I would say on trends is this concept, category management, which a lot of us are still wrapping our minds around. There's a lot of great information out there. And so my team is really looking into how that affects us. And what we've seen initially is kind of what we were talking about before is we, as a small business, we really have to define what we bring to the market, because now you have categories of those items, those buckets. I need to fit into these buckets, right? And then really understanding how the government is buying out of those categories and what GWACs are using, what vehicles they're using. So I think it's actually a good trend. I think it's a good thing that the government is going to that. It makes it a bit easier to kind of understand where you fit in, but it does present some challenges to some small businesses in that you really have to take that time and define who you are and what you bring to the market.
I'm surprised that you think category management's a good thing. There's a ton there I want to get to, but I'm going to go back to pricing for a quick second. When you talk about pricing, when you started down that path, I was like, is he going to talk about LPTA, lowest price technically acceptable? And you didn't bring it up, which is maybe a good thing, because that means and maybe we've passed that concern over LPTA. Are you still seeing LPTA, but they're calling it a different name, or is it just the constant downward pressure that everyone feels on pricing?
Definitely think it's the latter. I think everyone's feeling that downward pressure, which pushes us to a position of staying lean, keeping your overhead down, keeping your G&A down, a lot easier in the small business space than our largest experience. I don't see a lot of bids that are actually explicitly saying LPTA. We try to personally stay away from those, but price pressure is always there. You know, it's that factor that, you know, they say, well, price is not a factor. Well, it's always a factor. And I think, you know, part of it is really being a good steward of the government's and the taxpayers' dollars and pricing things the right way. So, you know, industry, I think, is trying to meet. It's kind of a meeting of the minds with the government on what that really means. So there's a window there of, you know, an upper and lower bound. But at the same time, we can't always be at that lower bound, right? Because at the end of the day, you kind of get what you pay for. So
and I think that's what the government found with LPTA.
Yes,
is you
absolutely
get what you pay for. how much of the discussion you have with your federal clients or potential federal clients comes back around to best value as well? Yes, we are 3% more, but here's what you're getting for that 3%, or that discussion that you don't even get to that discussion because they say, well, I could do it over here for, you know, $100,000 and you're $120,000, and you have to be able to articulate that value in your proposal. I mean, is that the biggest challenge?
We have to articulate it in the proposal. I think, you know, you obviously hit the evaluation factors, but that extra dialogue about the why on your pricing and really taking the time to dive into, you know, where you may be higher in certain areas and why, I think it is important. If you're kind of shooting at a moving target, you don't really know what the target pricing is. You don't really know if I'm super low or not, right? But, you know, being that you have experienced pricers and you have a good proposal team, they can kind of get a feel for, okay, yeah, we're bare bones here, or we have a little too much meat on this, and let's trim it down a little bit. So if we're given an opportunity, like in a scenario of a BAFO, then yeah, I mean, we definitely, in certain areas we can cut, areas that we feel strongly about, we'll make that case as far as why they should be paying a little bit of a premium for this type of work.
BAFO, one of my favorite acronyms, best and final offer.
Yes.
Come on. We all knew that. Let's talk category management a little bit, because I think one of the biggest challenges I think the contractors are facing is this push for mandatory that's not mandatory. No one wants to use that term. That's the third rail of government contracting. And even GSA will say, well, we don't want that to be mandatory. But then they have this best-in-class contract, the term. And I always ask this question. I've written about this quite often. If you're not best in class, then are you worst in class?
Right.
Are you meh in class?
Yeah.
And people are probably tired of me saying that. Why do you think category management is a good thing?
There's pros and cons to everything. I think.
Are you a politician? Because that's a good political answer. Pros and cons.
There are.
GAO,
right?
more progress made. Sorry, go ahead.
No. Yeah, I mean, I think there are some good attributes with it. If you're new to the federal space, sometimes it can be a bit overwhelming with all of the information, all of the types of buys that they have. Do I need a schedule or not? We happen to not be in that case, but I think back to when I first started, that could be overwhelming. Having some more structure to that acquisition and buying process. Now, what I think we debate on the con side is, how's that really going to work, right? When you talk about, you know, things like strategic sourcing, how is it that much different than strategic sourcing and things like that, right? We see in certain cases, the government may feel like, hey, I'm increasing competition in this area. But hey, if I want to do work in DHS right now, right, and I'm not on OASIS, then is that really promoting competition, right? And so that, you know, you understand it, but then when you're there, rubber meet the road, I want to compete on something in a space that has a mandatory strategic sourcing requirement, it makes it very difficult, right? You have to find someone to partner with. And while I think the government says, hey, you know, find someone on OASIS to partner with, you know, sometimes that's not the best route, right?
And those people already have a set of teaming partners. So unless if you're doing something that's so innovative and so different, and let's be honest, I mean, a lot of people probably aren't, getting that relationship, it becomes even more difficult. I think that when you talk about category management, it works on an agency level. I think you have great examples at DHS where they've used category management really mm-hmm. smartly, at Commerce Department where they've used category management really smartly. Where I'm seeing the challenge is the government-wide perspective.
Yes, yes.
And that bleeds into the impact on all firms, but mostly small businesses. And the example I use all the time is on office supplies. They went from about 400 to 500 people in companies under Schedule 75 to 13
right.
or 15, 13 small, 15 all together. And they were saying, you know, the administration would tell you, well, 76% of all of those buys went to small businesses. And well, 76% of went to 13 instead of 50% or 40%
right.
Went to 300.
Sure.
Does that worry you that as they start to look at professional services, which is not really right in many ways for category management, because you're not buying a pen or a pencil.
A product, right.
Yeah, you're buying someone's brain.
Yes, absolutely.
Does that worry you that path is tougher for professional services?
Yeah, and again, I think it depends on how the government implements it. I think at the highest level, yes, it makes sense. Okay. I mean, category management has been around in the retail space for years and years and years, right? But then when you get down to some of the nuances that we deal with in the federal space with respect to acquisition strategies and those types of processes, the devil's in the details, right? So, you know, you could say, well, maybe I should have it down to the best 13. Well, then how do I determine who the best 13 are? And what if the 14th person is really good and they're just getting into the party? How do I on-ramp that person, or do I, right? And again, I go back to Oasis, you know, the on-ramp, you know, is it spreads out over time. So, hey, if you don't get it this time, you may be waiting, you know, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years for the next go around. That's a long time, you know, in our market, right? So I think the devil's in the details, how they implement it. I think from that standpoint, government really needs to have a real dialogue with industry and allow industry to talk to them about some of the challenges that we see with the approach down at the detail level.
Do you feel like you've had that opportunity, whether it's with GSA or whether with a specific agency, or is that not quite there yet?
It's getting there. I think at conferences, you see a lot more dialogue, open dialogue with industry. I think the conferences that I've been to lately, industry has come with some really good questions. And government, I think, has answered those questions. And they would say, hey, we haven't approached that yet, but we're willing to talk to you about it or something like that. It's better than it used to be. I think that communication channel is a lot better than it used to be.
All right, well, that's good news. And we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, you mentioned Oasis a couple of times. Maybe we'll start there. I can find out where you guys are at with Oasis. There's a big on-ramp coming up. My guest is Walter Barnes, the president of PM Consulting Group. I'm Jason Miller, and you're listening to Views from a Corner Office on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back. You're listening to Views from a Corner Office on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest is Walter Barnes, the president of PM Consulting Group. Walter, we spent the first half of the show talking about the state of the federal market, some of the trends you're seeing. Let's talk about you a little bit. You mentioned Oasis a couple times, and I know that a couple people have brought up to my attention that the Oasis, which is a big professional services GWAC, government-wide acquisition contract that GSA runs, is in the middle of some on-ramps. And that led me to wonder, are you guys on Oasis? Are you guys trying to get on Oasis? What's the status?
We are trying to get on Oasis. And you hit the nail on the head. It's, from a professional services standpoint, is extremely important to be on Oasis. So we submitted our proposal for Pool 1, which was, you know, maybe a few months ago. And then, you know, recently it was protested and rumored to be pulled back. And it will be reissued, you know, at some point in the future. And so we still remain excited and enthusiastic about it. This time around, you know, we're able to look at it and make sure that we are maximizing our points, because it's a point-based, system with Oasis. And there's different ways to kind of maximize your points. And quite honestly, some of the language in the solicitation is up for interpretation. So we found ourselves debating a lot about, well, what does that really mean, you know, and who can we partner with, and do we have that qual and that kind of thing. But we're excited. I mean, I think if we can get on that, that's definitely going to fuel a lot of our growth going forward, especially, you know, a lot of the work that we're targeting in the DHS space.
What's your take on the self-evaluation, not just Oasis, but this concept more generally? I had a recent conversation for a story I'm working on about CPARS.
Mm-hmm.
You know that acronym?
Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
I figured you did.
Yeah.
But it's basically the contractor rating system.
Yes.
And CPARS plays a big role in a lot of times those point evaluations. Do you like this concept of self-evaluation? Do you not like it? What's your overall take? And aside from Oasis, we're not talking about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that concept is good. I think that, you know, the goal is obviously to try to find the best companies and as identified by their clients, right? And so, you know, if your client's saying, hey, you're doing a heck of a job, then you're there. But if not, you know, there's some challenges there. So from a government standpoint, you know, that's a way to look at performance. I think self-evaluation, I will go back to Oasis, so the self-scoring, you know, being able to look at that scoring matrix up front and see, you know, where do we fit in? Does it even make sense to make this investment to do the proposal or not? I think it's great. You know, I mean, it helped us kind of say, hey, if we can't get to X thousands of points, we got to try again next time. And we at least know what we need to target. We need to target ISO. We need to target CMMI. We need to, you know, get the clearance upgrade and some things like that will give us more points to get onto the actual vehicle. And it made us look at, you know, where we really stand in those categories and those measures that they're looking at that make up that scoring matrix.
That's nice to hear because I was never sure how people feel about that self-scoring system because it's different, it's new, and, you know, what would stop you from giving yourselves an A-plus all around? Yeah. Well, eventually it may catch up to you. Let's talk a little bit more about PM Consulting Group. You mentioned you're not on Oasis. What vehicles do you have? You mentioned 8A. You mentioned HubZone. What else? And then what do you guys do? Give me the 50,000-foot view.
Sure. So we are currently on the GSA PSS A74, which previously was MOBIS. We're on that schedule, SINs 1 and 7. We're looking to expand both in the SINs, but also you know, the labor categories. We're working on a proposal now that will help modify that contract and add, I think, 20 to 25 labor categories. When we first got on the schedule, we had, you know, we were very small at that point. So I think we were awarded like 9 labor categories or something like that. But now that we've done more prime work and we have a lot more variety of experience, you know, we're able to kind of add labor categories that then our clients can access us even more. It makes us more attractive on the schedule, and it's something that we can market.
Talk about what labor categories you're in. How big of a company are you guys? I know a small business, but I don't know if you talk about revenue or talk about how many people you have.
Yeah, so we, you know, right now in 2018, we did about $4.6 million. In 2019, we're poised to do around $10 million. And that's just current work. A lot of our larger contracts we won at the end of 2018. So this year, we're actually recognizing a lot of that revenue. We have about 75 W-2 employees. We have a host of 1099s that we work with as well. And that's up from last year, we had about 15 employees. So we had to grow up pretty quickly. And I want to give some kudos to my leadership team because they really took the bull by the horns and got us through that first wave, you know. And so having the HR, having the facility clearance, having, you know, all of these things that you have to have to actually manage your contracts effectively is what we had to do over the last, you know, 9 months.
That's incredible growth. How did you handle it? And were you able to find people? Because, you know, we always hear, especially in the Washington, D.C. area, it's hard to find people who not only have certain sets of skills, but also have these other things that come with it, like clearances.
Yeah, if you look at our management staff, every person on there I knew from previous jobs, right? So I worked at Booz Allen Hamilton, I worked at Bearing Point in SRA International, and every person there definitely I worked with in the past. So we had a pre-existing relationship. This next wave, which we're anticipating for this year, will be interesting because it'll probably be the first time that we are going to have to hire cold, right, and really go through that true interview process and figure out if these individuals are a good fit from a management standpoint. But definitely keeping that network, talking to people about where we are as a firm and things like that, and keeping their interest. Some folks, you know, I've known for 10 years, you know, and it was just talking over time, like, hey, when I need you, I'm going to call you, and I really need you to come at that point in time kind of thing. And we got to that point this past year, and luckily a lot of them were in a place in their careers where they could leave their large firm and come to PM Consulting Group, and they've added a tremendous amount of value.
Tell me a little bit more about your background. How did you get to PM Consulting? You worked at, you said, a couple of the big government contractors, yes, like Booz and Bearing Point, if people remember who they are. But what made you either A, jump to PM Consulting or start it?
I started my career at Naval Sea Systems Command when it was in Crystal City. And from there, I went to KPMG Consulting / Bearing Point, then went over to Booz Allen. So, you know, did the management consulting circuit. I went to work for a small company in Westminster, Maryland, that had a subcontract with General Dynamics. And we were doing, you know, project planning and control, you know, earned value scheduling and that kind of thing. And then from there, I started PM Consulting Group. Once that company left that contract, I picked it up, basically started PM Consulting Group, and went from there. You know, when I originally started it, it was more for me as an independent contractor. And then I actually went back into corporate world for a few years, which was a great experience. And then started the company back up at the end of 2013 with a real strategic plan. Like, hey, we're going to target the 8A. We're going to target Hub Zone. We're going to, you know, really build our capabilities out. We're going to figure out this capture process and really instill some discipline into what we're doing and really make a run at it. And we're starting to see some of the benefits of that now.
Always love the story. Were you at your dining room table or a garage or what's when the first parts of PM Consulting, did your wife or family look at you with three eyes? Give me the backstory.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I come from an entrepreneurial family. You know, we all grew up, we had a upholstery business in Hampton, Virginia, my grandparents owned. So
you're getting ahead of my favorite question. So go ahead. So anyways, you grew up. Go ahead.
So my family looked at me like it was no big deal. Like, hey, we knew this was coming. You know, I always had that kind of entrepreneurial blood in me. A lot of my family members own their own companies or their consultants as well. So it was kind of just following that model that my grandparents set. And what I really learned from them is, hey, there's no limit in what you can do. But I will say that my large business experience definitely set the foundation. I was very fortunate to have great managers in all the companies that I worked at that really saw something in me and kind of went that extra mile to show me this or show me that. And then, you know, my experience at SRA was great because it was my first executive level experience, which allowed me to see companies at the very highest level of the organization. And that helps me, you know, manage and strategically process things here at PM Consulting Group.
All right, very nice. We're going to take a quick break. Before we do that, always this is my favorite question of any interview is, tell me something outside of PM Consulting. Tell me something about yourself that maybe most people don't know.
I was a college DJ, or I would say MC. My best friend in college, he was a real DJ. He had the crates of records and stuff. And this was 97, 98 at Virginia Tech. And we had the hip-hop and R&B kind of segment at Virginia Tech Radio. A lot of people don't know about that, but it was a great experience. And, you know, in a lot of cases, it was preparing people to go out that night and hang out. And so everyone's listening to the radio. And so we had a nice segment there for 2 years. And this being here brings back a lot of good memories, too. So.
And one thing you told me off line, but I'm going to ask you to tell the audience this, is you had a lot of callers who call in. And yeah. who were among the most popular callers?
Most popular callers were the guys at the Montgomery County prison facility that was down in Montgomery County, Virginia, which is the county that Blacksburg is in. And they would call in and ask for all kinds of stuff. And it's like, you know, I can't play that explicit stuff, but we can play this. You know, so Biggie, Tupac, that was kind of that era. They wanted to hear it. And they would always say, hey, man, thanks, you know, kind of thing. And we would shout them out all the time. So I never actually ran into anyone from the prison system, but it was really cool to kind of give them that kind of, hey, voice, if you will.
A little bit of outside from the prison system. All right, very cool. A former DJ, I'll let you run the board before we get you to leave.
Excellent.
Let's take a quick break. My guest is Walter Barnes, the president of PM Consulting. I'm Jason Miller, and you're listening to Views from a Corner Office on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back. You're listening to Views from a Corner Office on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest is Walter Barnes, the president of PM Consulting Group. Walter, we spent the last segment getting to know you and PM Consulting Group a little bit. One thing that we didn't get a chance to touch upon that I'd like to is the fact you guys are both 8A and a Hub Zone company. I think the success and the reasons and the kind of the backstory about 8A is pretty clear about why it's an important program. Hub Zone, on the other hand, has been one of those things that started back in the late 90s as a good idea, but has been really struggling as a program because of some of the requirements. And you're starting to see Congress and the SBA change the requirements a little bit. From your perspective, when you guys, how did you decide to be a hub zone? And then how are you able to meet those requirements of having X amount of employees that live in a hub zone? That, because a lot of times, and this is the biggest challenge, is people who live in the hub zones are not necessarily qualified for higher end work like IT, like professional services. So I know that's always been a big challenge for all hub zone companies.
It is. It's definitely a challenge. I think the key is to kind of keep your eyes on that metric. And I wouldn't say that we make hiring decisions based on that. But, you know, depending on what the project is, where the project's located, you may have, you know, more employees in that space that are in the hub zone. The other thing that, you know, a lot of hub zones are starting to kind of band together. There's a couple of organizations out there that do a really good job of trying to promote hub zone companies and promote more complex work to go through the hub zone program. Part of that is really hub zones coming together and saying, hey, there's at least two of us that can actually meet this requirement. To me, the government's starting to listen a bit more to those cases. You can see in the CFR where, you know, there's hub zone directed awards now and things like that. Some of the contracting officers are still being educated on how to actually do that and how it actually equates to the 8A program and what are some of the constraints. So I think a little more education around that would help the contracting community understand what they can do as far as leveraging hub zone companies' capabilities.
Remind me the percentage. You're supposed to have so much percentage of employees who live in a hub zone. How are you able to ensure that? Do you reach out? Do you do hiring fairs? Do you go to places where, okay, this is a hub zone, let's find people who live in that district?
Some of it is, you know, having a really good relationship with local colleges and universities where you can hire interns. I mean, the requirement is to have 40 hours a month on that employee for them to count, if you will. So that brings into play interns, that brings into play a lot of different other kind of scenarios where you can have some short-term help on certain things. But you know, for us, you know, if there's a hub zone out there trying to meet their goals, you know, establishing that relationship with local colleges, you know, HBCUs. You know, we have a relationship with Towson University. That's where we're located. Also, George Washington. You know, so hiring those students, giving them an opportunity, and that helps with your goals as well. But looking at strategically, you know, a company has to make that decision on whether or not the cost of maintaining their hub zone, right, is the ROI there? Are we seeing enough opportunities where I have an opportunity to bid on and I've won to kind of offset that cost? In certain cases, the answer is yes. Certain cases is not. We kind of got lucky. We have a contract down in Atlanta, south of the airport there. And it turned out that, you know, once we, you know, turned over all the employees, a lot of them actually lived in designated hub zones. And I use the word designated. So as a hub zone owner, you have to keep up with the hub zone map. It changes. So, you know, even your office may be in a hub zone 1 year, and then since this information comes out and it's not, right? So you really have to be on your toes in the hub zone.
Has that affected you? Have you had to move offices?
No, I have not.
That's good.
I've been lucky.
as a group who've just moved offices, don't move offices too often. Yeah. The other piece then is do you get it through the door not because you're a hub zone, but because of the services you're providing and because you're a hub zone? Like, how much is that helping you? Or is that just, again, like the icing on the cake piece?
This year, we've noticed a lot of targeted efforts from agencies to have hub zone only conferences or hub zone only industry days and that kind of thing. I would say this year I've seen more of those than I've seen in the past. And it's exciting because, you know, it's just like going to an 8A only conference. I know that, you know, Northrop Grumman's not going to be there or Booz Allen's not going to be there. It's all 8As and that's what we're here for. The hub zone conferences and them being open to us coming in and talking about what we can do for that particular agency and them communicating some of their issues to us as being hub zone companies, that dialogue is very important. you know, having that mechanism and the government recognizing that, you know, and again, it could be numbers driven or anything, but we have that platform now to actually go in and have the same conversations that 8As have been having for a number of years.
I want to shift gears because we're just about out of time, and there's a couple things I want to get to. One of them is this search for innovative companies, and there's this push that a lot of agencies, DOD is a prime example, for something called OTAs, Other Transaction Authority. And the whole theory behind that is, well, we want to reach non-traditional companies. At the same time, there's this, if you will, other desire of the government to reach small businesses because they can be innovative, they can be nimble, they can be, you fill in the blank. Do you see that as two diametrically opposed ideas, that you want companies to be innovative, you want us to be nimble, but then you're going outside of normal contracting approaches where we live? So what's your take on kind of this recent push?
Well-established small businesses will probably look at it and say, wow, I wish they had that, you know, when I was first starting, right? The challenge that we have as small businesses is there's so many things that you have to do just to get to the table. I've got to, you know, have my SAM registration. I've got to have, you know, if I have a facility clearance, I've got to have an FSO. I've got to have these positions. It's just a lot. There's a lot of overhead that goes into just getting to the table. I see the non-traditional route as being something for companies that may be coming out of the commercial space that have good technologies that are transferable to the government space and can add value, but not necessarily having to actually go through and jump through all the hoops just to get to the table up front. To me, it's a quicker way for the government to kind of get access to those firms and attract those firms, because, you know, I have colleagues that just do commercial work. They won't touch government work. You know, they cite the margins, they cite the high barrier of entry and the high competition, especially in the DC area. So, you know, this gives them an opportunity to kind of say, okay, yeah, maybe I will take a look at that.
But does that frustrate you? Because you're here, you've done all the investment, you've done all the work to get a SAM registration, to hire the people you need to hire. Does that frustrate you as a small business owner?
Me personally, not necessarily. And I think it's because of the actual industry that we're in within the federal market. We are not, you know, an IT firm. If I were a cybersecurity firm that had to do all this stuff up front just to get to the table, and then I see another firm coming out of the commercial space that just walks in the door, yeah, that would frustrate me. You know, when I look at professional services, you know, it's not so much as being innovative from a technical standpoint as more the heightened, you know, need to really take care of your employees, right? Because that's what you're, quote unquote, delivering to the government. Like you said, their brain power, their experience, and kind of being innovative on the internal side.
All right, very good. On that note, we're going to have to say thank you very much. Let me thank my guest, Walter Barnes, the president of PM Consulting Group. Walter, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you.
I'm Jason Miller, and you've been listening to Views from a Corner Office on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network.
You've been listening to Views from the Corner Office on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Tune in Fridays at noon or subscribe to this show on iTunes or Podcast One.